Good morning. Welcome back to the second hour of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for our program, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Jason Croft is at the controls this morning. We're here weekday mornings 10 to noon, 10 different topics for you each week. If you'd like to see the schedule, listen to past programs, sign up for podcasts, just take a look at our website. It's will.illinois.edu. In this hour of the show, we'll return to a topic that we've discussed before here on the program, and that is welfare reform. Back in 1996, a Democratic president, Bill Clinton, and a Republican-controlled Congress came together to pass what many people said was the most radical welfare reform bill ever to come out of Washington. There was a lot of concern about what the impact of this would be, particularly because it imposed a time limit on welfare benefits. And there was this concern that if the benefits ran out, and there were still people who had not managed to find work when the program was geared to encourage people to work, there would be serious consequences for those families and those people. The results of welfare reform seem to have been largely positive, at least initially. Welfare rolls dropped by over 60%. Black child poverty and poverty among children in female-headed families declined. And that has continued to be true, although in the last few years, certainly after the 2001 recession and recently, there are a lot of families who are suffering and having a tough time. We want to return to the topic this morning and talk a little bit about who it is that's still managing to fall through the cracks and some of the difficulties faced now by families that are poor but working. And our guest for the show is Dr. Randy Albelda. She's a professor of economics at the University of Massachusetts at Boston. She has worked as research director of the Massachusetts State Senate's Taxation Committee and also the legislature's Special Commission on Tax Reform, and does research and teaching on a broad range of economic policies affecting low-income families. And certainly one of the things that she has written on is welfare reform. She's joining us this morning by telephone. And as we talk, questions from listeners are certainly welcome. The number, if you're listening to us here in Champaign-Urbana, is 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that's good anywhere that you can hear us. So if it would be a long-distance call, you're listening over the air around Illinois and Indiana, or you might happen to be listening on the Internet, as long as you're in the United States, you certainly may use the toll-free line, and that is 800-222-9455. So again, here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455 and toll free 800-222-9455. At any point here, you have questions, you can certainly give us a call. Professor Albelda, hello.
Good morning.
Thanks very much for talking with us.
Sure.
This is, as I said, this is our interest in doing the show, I suppose, prompted by another program that we did not too long ago, talking about the welfare reform of 96 and trying to get a handle on what the impact of that was now all of these years later. And it seemed that at least in the estimation of the guests that we were talking to, that it was positive. Certainly positive initially, and even considering the downturn in 2001, that conditions for poor families in America were better, at least in the terms of people coming off welfare and people working, than they had been before. Now, there also was a question about what's happened now, maybe within the last year or so. But just as a general question, I'm wondering what your assessment of the welfare reform of 96 would be.
Well, my assessment is that welfare reform of 1996 changed the rules, but it didn't really address the issues facing low-income families, especially the families that were targeted under welfare reform, which are primarily single-mother families. So that it changed how people had to interface with the government to get supports. It promoted very rapid employment, but it didn't resolve the primary issues that face these families that keep them poor or low income. So that, you know, a success in terms of having fewer people claim this particular benefit, that absolutely happened. If you want to measure success by increasing employment levels among single mothers especially single mothers with young children, that happened too. But in terms of improving the well-being of those families, I think that on average, it didn't do that. And indeed, what it has done is it squeezed these families' time in new ways. And also, it has brought to light a whole set of dilemmas and trade-offs for low-income families that need resolving that welfare reform didn't resolve. Hmm.
Well, let's come back to that in a moment, but I'm interested in maybe asking you to address this concern that people had initially because there was going to be now a time limit on benefits. And that was, what happens if you have someone, maybe you have a family, where the benefits period runs out and that whoever heads that family still hasn't managed to find work? These people essentially would be completely out in the cold, so to speak. Did that actually happen? Were there people who the benefits ran out and that was simply it?
Well, I'm sure it's happened, and there's been a little bit less research on this, in particular the effects of time limits. But the other thing that's happened is that people play the clock now. That is, they're discouraged by their caseworkers or if they can find out information themselves about collecting over long periods of time. Some states have been able to provide exemptions for families that use cash assistance for long periods of time. And, I mean, for those families, they often face enormous barriers to employment. But the more typical, first of all, I've actually stopped talking about welfare reform and talking more about low-income families and about a whole set of public supports because so few families now are even eligible, and even those who are eligible, the vast majority don't collect cash assistance of this form. So it's really a program, something like 1.5 of the population is even receiving this cash assistance at any point in time. When we have poverty rates, and poverty rates really underestimate the percentage of families that are in need, of about 12 to 14%. So this is a program that really is addressing very, very few people, and the typical pattern for families who use cash assistance, TANF, you know, what we formerly called welfare, is to cycle in and out of using it, to try and rely on other forms of income, often earnings. What TANF did, the change, you know, the personal responsibility Opportunity Reconciliation Act did, was to make it harder to work under the table, which is what a lot of families were able to do. They weren't able to meet needs sufficiently, but with work requirements and requirements to go into the office and deal with caseworkers all the time, this has become less of a viable option. So families tend to, you know, adults in these families tend to go in and out of employment. What we do know has happened, whether people have hit their time limits or not, is that a larger percentage of people are now relying on neither earnings nor public supports. So what has happened is that the percentage of families who are very poor has gone up. But in fact, I think welfare reform has, quote unquote, worked in the sense that it has made the receipt of cash assistance less accessible. That is, that part of the safety net is gone. And so families need to rely on either different kinds of supports and other forms of resources to package their needs. And what that has meant is that more and more families are relying on earnings. But while we reformed welfare, we did not reform the low-wage labor market. And in fact, the low-wage labor market in some ways is worse now than it was 10 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Just because overall economic conditions are
partly bad. It's economic conditions, but it's also the fact that a larger percentage of employers don't provide health insurance now than they did 10 years ago. So the minimum wage, the real value of the minimum wage, is lower now than it was 10 years ago. so that the low-wage labor market hasn't been changed whatsoever, yet more and more low-income mothers have to rely on that form of income. And so there's this incredible mismatch between the lives of many of these women and the employment demands of their employers. There's also a new mismatch between the support system. Besides cash assistance, there are other forms of public supports that are available to families, low-income families. Probably the most important and the one that we spend the most money on is Medicaid, health insurance for low-income families. But there are other ones. There's food stamps. There's housing assistance. There's child care assistance. There's the Earned Income Tax Credit. But all of these programs are separately run. For example, in Illinois, if you wanted to collect any of these six, except for the Earned Income Tax Credit, which you could fill out a two-page tax form, to collect any of these other ones, you would have to go to separate agencies in the state, fill out different forms, provide different kinds of documentation, and maybe be eligible for them, maybe not. As you work more, if you earn $10 an hour, $11 an hour, chances are you won't be eligible for many of them.
Well,
so what we've done is we've changed the rules for poor families, especially single mother families, and these are parents who have primary responsibility, often for young children. So now the rules say you must be employed. Unless you have a very severe disability or you're taking care of a child with a very severe disability. Now, there's some positive aspects about this. That is, now everyone's a worker in the United States. And if everyone's a worker and everyone has to support themselves through employment, we really need to think about low-wage employment. And the set of support systems. Each of the set of support systems I named, with the exception of the Earned Income Tax Credit, and possibly child care, though there's different issues around the development of child care, were all developed for very poor families who were not expected to have employment. Now we have a system in which we expect everyone to be employed, but the support system makes it very hard. There's now a new mismatch between the support system and employment and employed parents. We did. I just did a large study where we looked at the percentage of families who could meet their needs based on the actual cost of living in 10 states, including Illinois, and we found on average that about 22% of people in families with earnings didn't make enough, coupled with these sets of supports that I just named, you know, income tax credit, food stamps, Medicaid, child care assistance, housing assistance, and TANF. 22% of people in families with earners couldn't meet their basic needs between earnings and these supports. So we've said, go to work, but work doesn't pay. And part of the agreement around welfare reform is we're going to cut cash assistance, but we're going to make sure that you have child care and health insurance, at least for a year. And we're going to increase the Earned Income Tax Credit, all of which was done. Right after welfare reform, the state child insurance program CHIPS was passed, which has been a great success. But still, 22% of people in families with earners can't meet their basic needs. We did focus groups, and what we found, of course, is that as soon as people did have some earnings to get food stamps or to keep their food stamps, they had to leave work to be recertified to get $20 worth of food stamps. Most people decided that wasn't worth it. We talked to people who said, well, I get child care support, I get some subsidies, but now I earn $12 an hour and my copayment is so high I can't afford it, I had to quit my job. So we've set up a system that says, go to work, we'll give you some supports, but the work doesn't match the workers, and I can talk more about that. There's a lot of problems between low-wage work and single mothers. And the support system doesn't match the workers. So was welfare reform a success? Well, it was a success in that we essentially eliminated that program. And if that was the goal, that's fine. And we've improved employment rates among mothers. But have we made these families better off? At least in the short run, my answer would be no. There's still a lot of work to be done. We really need to rethink both the low-wage labor force as well as the set of support systems that we have for low-wage workers.
Let me introduce again our guest for this part of Focus 580, Randy L. Belda. She's a professor of economics at the University of Massachusetts at Boston, and in her research and teaching is interested in a broad range of economic policies affecting low-income families. One of the things that she has written on is welfare reform, and we're talking about that, but also the conditions for the working poor, essentially, here in the United States, and what that's like. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Well, I'm curious here if you can put some numbers on income. That is, how many people we're talking about who are, say, making more than the official poverty line, so they're over that line, and yet they're really not making enough to actually be able to make ends meet, maybe even with some of the kinds of work supports that we've talked about.
Well, let me give you some figures. In 2006, the poverty rate was 12%, which was about 36 million people. And the poverty rate essentially is, for your listeners who aren't as wonkish as someone like myself, is calculated by the U.S. Census Bureau based on income thresholds that were developed in the 1960s. And those income thresholds at the time were based on family budgets, in which it was estimated that about a third of family budgets at the time, of low-income families' budgets, were spent on food. And so those thresholds were based on the cost of food for low-income families of different sizes. And since the 1960s, those thresholds have been adjusted for inflation. So, for example, in 2006, the poverty income threshold for a family of three was about $16,000 a year. What that means is when the U.S. Census Bureau collects data on family income and you report that you have $14,000 a year, you're counted. You and the rest of your family members are counted as poor if you're in a family of three. Mm-hmm. That comes out to be about $1,333 a month. Now, I'm not 100% sure what the cost of housing is in Champaign, Urbana, but my guess is it's probably close to around $700 or $800 a month for a two-bedroom house place. Am I off?
It's been a while since I've looked at that, but I would think you'd probably be lucky if you'd find decent place.
Okay, so it's $1,000 a month. I live in Boston, and the housing, I mean, it's just, I didn't want to overestimate, but let's say it's between $700 and $1,000 a month. So you would have, so $16,000 a year would barely get you housing, but you would be counted as poor. So often what many researchers now and even some politicians and policy advocates tend to talk about low-income families instead of poor families. And so when we say low-income families, the sort of people tend to have converged on an agreement about what that means. And it's 200% of the poverty line. So for a family of three, that would be $32,000 a year would – if you lived in a family that had $32,000 a year or below, that would put you as low income. Now, part of the problem with this measure is it's the same in Wyoming as it is in California. And certainly the cost of living, for example, in Massachusetts, is much higher than it is in Montana. So it has its problems. But in 2006, there were 90 million people in low-income households. That's 30% of the population. So the difference between what you were trying to say is poor and, in low income is about it's 55 million people, but 90 million people, almost one-third of the population and close to 40% of all children are in families that have income below 200% of the poverty line. Hmm. So we're talking about substantial numbers of people.
And I would expect that, now in 2008,
yes,
it would be more.
That's right. That's right. In the research project we did, we estimated, we actually tried to improve on the measure of poverty, and we looked at what are often called family budgets or self-sufficiency budgets for different areas, so we were able to adjust for cost of living. And we estimate that 41 million people nationwide are in families with earners that can't meet their needs, even with the value of these public supports.
Mm-hmm.
So we're talking about a fairly large swath of the population. And by the way, the bottom 25% or 20%, doesn't matter how you know, whatever percentage you want to meet, over the last 30 years has not done very well, while the top 20 or 30% has. So we have a large swath of people who aren't meeting their needs, coupled with growing inequality. Which politically, I think, puts low-income families at a distinct disadvantage, because people, when you have growing inequality, there's less tendency to want to have policies to ameliorate that. So we have a situation that I think we need to really rethink both the set of supports that we provide low-income families, and we really need to think the way that we the minimum standards around low-wage employment. Let me give you an example. In my work, I call the low-wage work and single mothers, poor single mothers, a match made in hell. Let me explain why. A lot of low-wage work is in the retail and service sector, a good deal, especially those that employ women. There's still a good bit of gender segregation in low-wage work. These jobs, as anyone who's ever worked in retail and especially hospitality services, require workers to come in at often odd hours and irregular hours from week to week. So especially, you know, during Christmas time, you could work more hours than you wanted to. And then in January, you could work almost no hours. But often, you don't know what your schedule is 2 or 3 weeks in advance. Now imagine yourself with a four-year-old. And your four-year-old has a child care provider that you've managed to secure and that you can, you know, you may even have some support, some child care subsidy or assistance, but you don't know what your hours are in 2 weeks. Your child care provider wants to know when your child is coming.
Mm-hmm.
This creates enormous difficulties for these kinds of workers. Also imagine that your child gets sick one day. Now, this is not an atypical thing. Children tend to get sick. About half of low-wage workers have no sick days at work, no paid sick time off. So when your child gets sick and your child care provider won't take a sick child and your mother's also at work and your neighbor can't do it, you miss a day's pay. Now, if your child is chronically sick, has, for example, asthma, which is not classified as a disability, under these rules, you may miss 3 or 4 days over the course of the month. Both your coworker and your employer aren't very happy with that. So that it creates oftentimes for low-income families who live in low-income neighborhoods whose car breaks down or whose buses don't work or whose child gets sick, this very difficult pattern of having, you know, what I would call fits and starts. You may start with an employer, you may do very well, but if you miss too many days at work, first of all, you miss pay, but secondly, you jeopardize your job. And so you see a good bit of turning over, which, of course, means that when, you know, what all the research shows is you need to stay at a place in order to move ahead. So this low-wage work and mothers who are primary caregivers is a bad match.
We have a caller here. I want to bring them into the conversation. We are also at our midpoint here, and just very quickly, I'd like to also introduce again our guest, Professor Randi Albelda. She's professor of economics at the University of Massachusetts at Boston and is interested in a range of economic policies affecting low-income families. And among other things, she's written on welfare reform, on paid family leave policies, on gender and race in labor market segmentation, and also distribution of family income and earnings. And she's joining us this morning by phone. We're talking about welfare reform and also about the challenges faced by people who are working but not earning very much money. Questions welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. We have someone here calling in where we are in Champaign-Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hi. Can you list again the six basic assistance programs? And in the Midwest, there were news stories on Medicaid. It was sometimes some things were covered, but people had to travel far away, especially to find a clinic that would accept them. And there was a story that there was some tax help. You had to show proof of income, but for low-income people, it helped with utilities. But there were some hoops to jump through, like 50 people lined up at 6 a.m. and the doors opened at 9, and then they were told they had to come back another day and so forth. Okay.
Yes. Well, just to answer your question, in the research that we did, we looked the six supports that we looked at were TANF, temporary assistance to needy families, cash assistance, although if you work too many hours, you're not eligible. Food stamps, which actually eligibility goes up to about 133% of the poverty line. Child care assistance, and that varies by state and the amount that how much income you can have. But in some states, it actually goes up quite high. Medicaid and the CHIPS program, the state child insurance program. Housing assistance, mostly Section 8 or public housing, and then the earned income tax credit. So those were the six major forms of public supports that we looked at for families. And the caller is absolutely right. I mean, we did some focus groups in Minnesota and some in Illinois. And what we heard, which we didn't hear as much, for example, in Massachusetts or in D.C., was that people were eligible for Medicaid but couldn't find a provider where they lived, especially if they weren't living in one of the major cities. That was also very true around child care assistance. They would often not find a provider that would take their voucher. But actually, we heard more about people who just couldn't get child care assistance or housing, even if they were eligible, because the waiting lists were so long.
Just because of these, the programs we're talking about here, they're means tested. There is your eligibility depends upon your income.
Right.
I guess I wonder whether how many people there are who their earnings are low enough so that they would really benefit by some of these programs, and yet their earnings are high enough so that it just gets them over the line so that they're not eligible.
Yes, and that's exactly what we found. We estimated the percentage of people who were actually had need but weren't eligible for this assistance. And what we found was that in most states, with the exception of the Earned Income Tax Credit and the CHIPS program, the majority of families that were in need or couldn't meet their needs, couldn't pay for their basic needs, were also not eligible. So, for example, we looked at 10 states in D.C., and we found that 69% of the people and families that couldn't meet their basic needs were also not eligible for child care. 65% were not eligible for food stamps. 81% were not eligible for housing assistance. 90% were not eligible for TANF. Here's the program that's supposed to assist needy families, but 90% of needy families aren't even eligible for them. The best of them was the Earned Income Tax Credit, where 44% were ineligible, or half were, and Medicaid and CHIPS where about half were eligible. So these programs don't reach very far up the income ladder. And as a result, what's happened increasingly, and I work with a lot of groups in the Boston area that work with low-income families, and they're especially working with low-income, you know, they've made a huge effort, a lot of states have made a huge effort on employment training. And, you know, they put in a good deal of money to try and promote employment and then provide some of the training. And what they're finding is that they're working with these primarily women who have successfully entered the labor market. And they've moved from minimum wage up to $11, $12, $13 an hour. And these women are flabbergasted and because they've lost their support. So, for example, in many states, and Massachusetts is one, Medicaid for adults is about 150% of the poverty line. Well, that's $11 an hour in Massachusetts working full-time. So you start working, and you work as a medical technician or something, and you make $11.50 an hour, you lose your Medicaid. Now, if you're working as a medical technician, which is probably a good job, you're probably working for a hospital, they have health insurance. But your monthly payment is $150, $200 a month. Hmm. So even though your wage has gone up, you've lost, in effect, $200 a month or $150, whatever the employer copayment is, you know, the employee copayment, that's a loss. So that what we're finding a lot of providers, and we talked to, you know, a lot of families in which this was the case, was that they move up the income ladder, but they find they have less resources. And so this moving, you know, losing your eligibility or, what, you know, what we call a cliff or a slide. For example, we talked with one woman who said, I got a third job, but I discovered that when I took my third job, my child care copayment went up by more than I was earning. So even the incentives that were put into place for employment, a lot of now these public work supports, again, which were historically developed for poor single mothers who were not expected to work, the elderly and disabled, are finding that now they don't work very well with employment and need to be rethought. And that discussion hasn't been taking place, actually, either at the federal level or at the state level. I think some states are beginning to rethink about their application processes because many of them are very onerous. And we also estimated the percentage of people who are eligible who were not receiving. So we estimated the percent that were in this gap that couldn't meet their basic needs. We estimated the percentage of those that were in those gaps that were not eligible. We also estimated the percentage of people who were eligible but weren't receiving. And it varied by state, but there were patterns. Those that are eligible that were receiving, the highest percentage was among the Earned Income Tax Credit and Medicaid. Well, those are the two most well-promoted programs, and also the least onerous, and the least stigmatized. The programs that had the least amount of people using them, even though they were eligible, included TANF, which, of course, you know, is the poorest of the poor, and a very large percentage of those folks aren't receiving it, food stamps. And then also with child care and housing, a very large percentage of people are eligible but can't receive them, largely because they're on waiting lists. They're not funded. They're not what we call entitlements. So there's a huge gap in even given the faults of these programs, that is, they don't go way up the eligibility ladder, even among those who are eligible, especially if they're employed, they're not receiving them. So, again, like I said, I mean, we've tried to reform poor women, and maybe we have successfully done that in the sense that there's no expectation for cash assistance, which may be a good thing. I think that for women in particular, economic independence is crucial for them. And so one way you get that is through earnings. But we haven't really rethought very well or done very much about that low-wage labor market nor have we rethought the sets of supports that low-wage workers might need outside of the earned income tax credit. Hmm.
I have a couple of callers here. Just to, real quickly here, I would like to mention that if you were interested in taking a look at this research project,
yes,
that our guest was a principal author of, Bridging the Gaps is what it's called, and this was indeed, it was a multi-year, multi-state project that looked at public work supports in the United States. This was led by the Center for Economic and Policy Research and the Center for Social Policy at the University of Massachusetts, Boston. And you can read it online if you go to the website, go to www.bridgingthegaps, so do that with no spaces in between, all as one word, bridgingthegaps.org, and you can read it.
Thanks for
Yeah, no, definitely. I want to make sure, because I expect there will be some people who would really like to take a look at it and want to make sure that people know. Yeah, you got internet access
states,
to go online.
Yeah, one of the states we did look at, and we worked with partners in Illinois, was Illinois. So,
right. Okay. Let's talk with some other people who are listening. Up next, someone in here in Champaign County, where we are. This is line one. Hello.
Hi. I don't know how germane this is because it's so specific, but I've been trying to sort out what's going on with the Medicare renewal. There seems to be a bill, I forget what it was called, that sort of automatically put in cuts, and I think it's about 9% on the Medicare reimbursement. And that's being, I think there was a vote last before the 4th of July break that was in the Senate that failed by one vote, and I guess it's coming back up. And the... It's quite complicated, but it seems to me that one of the things that's going on is that apparently Medicare Advantage gets reimbursed at a higher rate than regular Medicare. So there's a not unexpected, I guess, tendency to favor these private, more privatized delivery systems, quote unquote. And that this bill apparently cuts that back and equalizes it, and that's apparently a veto threat, elicits a veto threat by Bush. But I just haven't heard very much discussion about this. It seems like it's a very critical thing. We've had a Medicare cut that was passed through by the state that's pretty much set our county nursing home towards, you know, bankruptcy. There are other things going on, but one of the things was this cutback, an earlier cutback that was only just passed through. How can you sort that out for me? Or I don't know if you're in a position of being in a firm that...
I'm afraid I can't. I don't know as much about Medicare, which is the universal program for people who are 65 and older, as I do about Medicaid, which is the more incomes-tested program for low-income people, regardless of age. I don't know as much about Medicare, and I would send you to Kaiser, who does a lot of work on that. What you're describing though does sort of promote this two-tiered set of reimbursements.
Right.
Say the extra.
All right. Thanks anyway. Bye.
Yeah.
All right, well, let's go on to another caller, someone in Peoria, line number four of the toll-free line. Hello.
Yeah, David, thanks for taking my call. A very interesting program, quite sobering. The numbers are more than a little terrifying. Was wondering if your guest, I'm probably going to overstate the obvious here, but I was wondering if your guest could talk about once these individuals fall into this position, and I can tell you with $4 a gallon gas, there's an awful lot of people suffering, even people making good livings. But I'm guessing that once these individuals fall into this situation, it's next to close to impossible to get out. And I'm just wondering if you can extrapolate the numbers out in the future. I would suggest that it's probably terrifying if you don't have a college education and the blue-collar jobs, well-paying blue-collar jobs are going away from us. I don't see this thing turning around anytime soon, and I don't know if there's a solution. I'll go ahead and listen off air. Thanks.
Yes, I think, we did our research before the upsurge in the price of gas and food. And so the caller is absolutely right. I mean, I think, and especially in rural areas, where the cost of both food and gas, well, maybe not food, it depends on where you get your food, but is going to be even more extreme. So, yes, I think the caller is absolutely right. It's only going to move up the income ladder. I'm not as pessimistic as he is, though. I see the opportunity of welfare reform in many ways. I've seen it across the states. I've always argued that I think the living wage campaigns, the paid leave, family paid leave, and sick day campaigns are inspired by or promoted by or have been given heft by welfare reform in the sense that we have said to most people in the United States, you must either get married and get your income from being married, which is becoming harder and harder, or you must have your own employment. Once we say that all able-bodied adults must have their earnings through employment, we're going to need to have sustainable employment. And so I think the solution, I think it has to be two-tiered solution. I think we need a solution that many other countries have, which are that we need minimum employment standards that are higher than the minimum standards we have now. We also need minimum public benefits or public support standards that are higher in almost every other industrial country than they are in the United States. For example, universal health care and universal child care, which would include after-school programs as well as early education care for 3 to 5-year-olds. I would also put paid family leave as part of a child care program for infants, will help tremendously low-income families. It'll also help all other families, too. But it'll make this particular problem, this mismatch between both work and the public benefit system and low-income families, much less. So whether that's an employer mandate or a government mandate, it doesn't matter to me. It's just that families need that, and it's going to make us a better and much more sustained country if we have those things. And as more and more people fall into this, there's more and more potential for it to happen. I'm not saying it's going to happen just because more people fall into it, but I think there's more potential to call it into question. There's always a tipping point with inequality. Historically, there's always been a tipping point with inequality. Once you get so much inequality, then there's some tipping point in which there's some call to reduce that inequality. And so once we hit that point and we have more calls to reduce that inequality, that is, you know, how much money do CEOs need, especially at the expense of you know, the bottom 60-70%, that we will begin to address these questions by applying, like I said, minimum employment standards that are higher than we have now and minimum support standards that are higher than we have now. And like I said, every other industrialized country has more of both. And at the moment, they seem to be doing a little bit better than we are.
Something that I think we tend to underestimate, that is, we underestimate the importance of, are benefits that people get through their jobs in addition to the wages.
So
we're talking about things like health care, paid vacation, sick leave, the chance to participate in some sort of retirement plan. How many low-income workers work in jobs where they don't get any of that?
Yes. Well, we did some estimates of what we call good jobs and bad jobs. That is the percentage of jobs that have pay $16 an hour, also provide an employer-sponsored health insurance plan, and also provide some kind of a retirement plan. And it varied by state, but what we found was that the share of good jobs, for example, in Illinois was 27%. The share of bad jobs, the share of jobs that paid less than $16 an hour, had no health insurance, employer-sponsored health insurance, and had no employer-sponsored retirement plan, was higher in Illinois. It was close to 30%. So, So a larger percent of jobs don't provide that than do. A recent report out of the Urban Institute found that that something like, only 69% of jobs that employed people without college degrees provided health benefits. So many workers have these benefits, like something like 83% of all workers have health insurance, and the majority, just over the majority, have a pension plan, and two-thirds of workers get some sick pay time. But of those who don't, they're disproportionately low-wage workers. So we have a two-tiered system around employer benefits. And that's, you know, that's why in this paper, in this research, we call for both, that, you know, I mean, you can do it one of two ways. You can make them employer mandates, or you can make them govern, you know, make them public support systems. But in any event, families need them. And I think the long-term damage we're doing, not just to those families, but the communities and to us as a whole, is going to be substantial. And it's when you have 30% of the population, or, you know, whatever, 25% of the population that can't meet their basic needs, that's gonna hurt the communities they live in, the states they live in, the country they live in, down the road. And again, in my mind, it's largely a question of distribution.
We are close to the end here. Maybe we have about 3-4 minutes. I have another call I want to get. Let's do that. Effingham, line 4. Hello.
Yes. Your last statements, by your own words, are proof that the capitalist system has failed, and has not failed for the first time, but as it evolves and the failures become more pronounced and more deadly, points to the fact that we need a huge change in human socialization. If we do not do that, and in this first world country, you know, the U.S. constantly propagandizes about this is the greatest country in the world and yappity yap, and it is not. But if it is representative of the greatest country in the world, then we are in a heap of trouble. Thank you.
Well, we certainly have left a large number of people and families behind. That there's no question about that. And, you know, there's a huge range of capitalist economies that, you know, it's hard to say capitalism as a whole has failed when, you know, I mean, U.S. capitalism is really different than, say, capitalism in Norway. So I think there's plenty of, let me put it this way, there's enormous room for improvement. And, you know, nobody wants to give up anything. On the other hand, nobody will give up anything without a struggle or without, you know, without being made to do it. And again, that's a political question much more than an economic question.
Do you see or hear the two men that we know are going to be the candidates of the two parties running for president talking about these issues at all?
No, I think once John Edwards left the presidential primaries, all the candidates stopped, talked a lot less about these issues. I do think that, you know, just based on my own knowledge of some of the things that Senator Obama was working on before he ran for president, I think he is somebody who has in the past, and I hopefully will in the future, address some of these issues around the mismatch between employment and families. You know, what we often call work-family policies. Those policies will disproportionately help low-income families. It's a much safer way of addressing them because they address all workers, but they disproportionately address low-wage workers. So I have to say, you know, in terms of the two candidates, I would put much more stock in Barack Obama addressing some of these issues than I would John McCain. But again, once John Edwards left the race, this attention to, you know, the two Americas has taken a back seat.
Very quickly here, we'll try to get one more caller. Urbana, line 1. Go ahead.
Hello?
Yes?
Yeah, you were talking about good jobs, bad jobs in Illinois. I just had a comment that Illinois' pension fund is I think 49th in terms of underfunding of all the states. So even jobs that might look like good aren't necessarily
yes.
good.
Yes, I think that a lot of state pensions are going to face some difficulties in the next decade or so. Yeah, you're right. And even these, you know, all pensions, not just in the state but others. Well, yes, I think that's right.
We're just about at the point we have to finish up. Any last thought that you'd like to leave with the listeners?
Well, I guess I would have listeners think. I think we have to think differently about post-welfare reform in the United States and think more broadly about the sets of supports all families need, and lifting the bottom, in fact, I think will help all of us, not just those at the bottom. And the costs of not doing so, I think, are quite high. I think inequality is quite costly, maybe not to the very top, but to the rest of us. And so I think we just need to rethink not just employment, but also the whole set of support systems that we have for all families.
Well, once again, if people are interested in looking at this report that our guest, Professor Albelda, has contributed to, Bridging the Gaps, this is a report that looks at public work supports in the United States and looks specifically at 9 states, one of them being Illinois. This was a joint project involving the Center for Economic and Policy Research and the Center for Social Policy at University of Massachusetts, Boston. You can just go to their website. It's bridgingthegaps.org. Our guest, Randy Albelda, is Professor of Economics at the University of Massachusetts, Boston. Professor Albelda, thanks very much for talking with us today.
Thanks for having me on your show.